You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
TMZ, oh my goodness.
I think he's the philosopher of football.
I'd like to have some more derbies.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory. We're trying to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental from the AT&T MLS Studios in Midtown Manhattan. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, David Goss and Bobby Warshaw, who are beefing. Have a little bit. There's a little something going on here. Got you.
Partner.
So if you see some, you know, if you're watching on YouTube and you just kind of see a wall between the two, you'll know why. But that probably means a great show. And you know what else means a good show? Greg Berhalter, head coach of the U.S. national team. He's going to stop by for a 25-minute chat about all manner of things, from deep dives on tactics to dual nationals to Paxton Pomykal to Serginho Dest. So you'll stick around for that one. We will also chat with Nashville SC GM Mike Jacobs about Hani Mukhtar, their new DP. They flew him in on PJ, private jet, coming from Bromby, has time with the German youth national teams. He's got some insight for us on how they're building their team and why we should not, I repeat, should not compare their team, their build, to others in the past. So stick around for those, the mailbag, but let's start with the trophy. U.S. Open Cup, baby. How quick could I say treble? I think this is probably about 2 minutes into the show. So for everybody who tweeted at me that Atlanta United are not chasing the treble, well, you've got your little bingo square filled in. They did win Campeones Cup, which I kind of forgot on the last show. They definitely won U.S. Open Cup. Big 2-1 win against Minnesota United that looked like it was going to be a 5-0 win. I'm personally gutted that I was not able to be there. I think that's, I don't know, I've got like three or four in a row at this point. That streak is now broken. What's it mean? How much does it matter? Atlanta was jacked about it. Minnesota, rightfully so, were gutted because Michael Boxall was on the edge of the six-yard box with a wide-open net, and he skied it in stoppage time.
That wasn't the only chance.
That's true. They had a lot.
Yeah.
A couple offset pieces.
Molino had a huge chance. Boxall had one earlier. Chase Gasper had a big look as well. As you said, 25 minutes in, the game was over.
Yeah, it felt
There's
like
no
it.
Way at home. 2-0 up, Atlanta United takes their foot off the gas and doesn't get that thing done. And then credit to Minnesota, they found a little bit more composure. Atlanta missed a couple opportunities, and then they kind of did what you thought they'd do, which is like hit on the counter a couple times, try and take advantage of set pieces, and they got their looks. They just couldn't finish.
Robin Lode with a beautiful goal right at the beginning of the second half, just to kind of kick things up a notch to convince everybody, hey, I'm not going to bed just yet. I'm sticking around. What'd you think, Bobby?
There's so many things to think about right now. First of all, Darwin Quintero not starting his team's first cup final.
I'm sorry, was anyone surprised by that?
Yeah, what do you mean was not? He's their first DP. He is undoubtedly their best striker. He is undoubtedly the biggest player in that club's history.
Okay,
attacker.
He's their most productive attacker by the numbers. We can say that.
But you're going to Atlanta. How are you going to set up? You know exactly how you're going to set up. No, you're going to set up to try and make it through the first 20 without giving up a goal. And then at 45, you assess where you're at, and you're like, can we roll the dice and put Darwin Quintero on the field? Right? Isn't that what you thought going into
the flip side
of
that is that he had scored a ton of goals in this tournament. The other side of that is he hadn't been very good for about 2 months in MLS.
This team, in New Mexico.
Listen, this team in 2 years at a talent deficit never set up to survive. Right? Like if they had set up to survive, they wouldn't have broken the league record for goals conceded for two straight years.
Sure, but they wanted to win now. Now you want to
win. And they didn't want to win for 2 years?
I don't know.
Like,
but
why?
They gave up
what makes you think?
Goals.
What makes you think 3 years into their MLS tenure, they all of a sudden were decide to have defensive shape and structure?
They went out and got Parra and Ozzie Alonso.
Why all of a sudden would you become more defensive in your shape and structure when you have two elite players? Like, I have no idea why you think when you're at a talent deficit, you wouldn't be more defensive than when you
because
get Aiko Parra.
Because when you play at Atlanta United, if you can get through 20 minutes without conceding a goal, they panic, they get frustrated, and the game gets easier for you.
You're right. That's fair. What they're doing is logical. Why you think it's obviously logical for Minnesota United, I do not know.
Why it's obviously logical, I think, is because reading between the lines, I don't know this, but it feels like Adrian Heath does not trust Darwin Quintero. And it doesn't feel to me Darwin Quintero will be in this team after this season. So you make a decision, Adrian Heath, in this moment, that you're going with the guys that you can trust. You went out in the summer transfer window, you got Robin Lode, you got some reinforcements. Mason Toys played pretty well in this tournament for you. You think he's more of the future, and you send a message to Darwin Quintero, which, by the way, I'm sure that message has been sent multiple times over the last 2 months, because in this game, you can't rely on Darwin Quintero to do anything but, like, kind of be frustrated at times and maybe get out in the open field and do something special. Now, that could change the whole game.
For sure. 100%.
But it could change the whole game if he doesn't do the defensive work and he's not committed.
I just want to, it's not in any way obvious not to use Darwin Quintero. You guys are acting like it was a clear and definitive choice, right? There's plenty of teams around the world that just use a straight block of eight and let two people chip.
Oh, by the way, I was shocked that he wasn't in the starting
lineup. It's a crazy. Doyle and I were talking Tuesday before the game. Has there been a bigger lineup decision in Major League Soccer history heading into a cup final? Literally the only one we could compare, which isn't even the same stratosphere, was Tommy Meyer over AJ De La Garza, and I think it was the 2012 MLS Cup. We couldn't think of anything with the Revs, anything with the Dynamo. Nothing is even close to this, to not playing your best player in your first cup final.
Either way, they had the chances.
It's awesome.
Darwin or no Darwin.
All right, so moving to Atlanta United, okay? They're great, right? They are a very good team. I think this weird thing happened.
Hold on, time out. Just for Atlanta United Twitter, just repeat how you started.
No, Andrew, this is a thing that I've realized happens to me on a regular basis, where we argue over the tiniest margins, right? It's not. I was never saying that Atlanta United weren't good, right? They're a good team. They might even be a great team. We're talking about whether they're the second best team. They still probably aren't the second best team. It's an entirely different conversation to whether this team is good, whether this team is potentially dominant, and whether this team could still win the East, if not MLS Cup. And the way they set up is just causing opponents so many problems. Having Joseph up top, having Barco and Petey right in behind him, having Gressel and Miram take up the wide channels. They basically lost all structure, especially their counter-pressing structure. And when they lose it, they are in big trouble pretty much at all times, right? They are a counterattack waiting to happen. But just putting in the third center back and having the pace of Miles Robinson and the strength of LGP and Florentine Pogba has limited that risk. But yeah, they're to go back to the main point, Andrew, they are very good, and it's silly to get distracted by the other question.
Okay. What do you see in them right now, Dave?
What was the other question?
The other question was, who's the second best team in the league?
Got it.
Yeah, okay. That was the distractor. That was the framing with which people sort of like mob attacked Bobby, and maybe for good reason, depending if you agree or disagree. But like, I look at this team and I see two guys on the flanks, one who's a natural crosser with his right foot, who's among the best in the league, maybe the best, and Joseph Martinez knows who he is. He feasts on it, and Julian Gressel. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, Justin Miram has found a resurgence. I mean, it's like the old Graham Zusi move, just to the left side. And no, it's not his natural position. He wants to cut inside, but it works for him. Somehow, some way, he still gets inside, and he's got an eye for the ball, which he's always had. Now, he may not like the defensive responsibilities that come with it, and I doubt that he does, because he'd rather be in the attacking third trying to score goals. But when you put those guys together, you have Pogba, you have Robinson, and you have LGP, and then behind that, Rometty, who doesn't get enough credit, and Darlington Nagbe not giving up the ball in bad spots, well, there's your platform. That's the platform that Petey Martinez was looking for all year long, that Barco needed all year long, and that Joseph Martinez takes to another level.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very, very, very good team, if not a great team. I think they're the second best team in the league, no doubt about it.
So the thing about a great team, though, is
better than NYCFC right now.
That's the question. That's the only question that Atlanta has as far as second best, because in the Western Conference, second place is like a juggling act. It's hot potato. Nobody can hold on to the thing.
So the one thing, though, is the way you describe the team and the way you look at this team, they have players who want to do specific things. I don't know that they still have a strong identity in that they can impose themselves on games, no matter what happens, no matter how the other teams play. They could do that last year. LAFC can do that this year. Toronto and Seattle could do that a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think NYCFC can do that this year. And that's the gap with Atlanta. It may not matter in 2019 in the Eastern Conference, because I don't know that there is a team that's good enough that can do that. But that is the biggest difference between what you saw last year and this year with Atlanta.
You summed that up so perfectly.
Thank you.
And it is scary if you're an Atlanta fan, it should be scary, by the way, and you might laugh this off, when you watch that Orlando game, and an Orlando team that frankly has, I mean, their level of attacking talent comparative to Atlanta's is not close, and yet they just created chance after chance after chance after chance against you.
But their structure was amazing, right? Going back to the structure with Minnesota United, they put numbers behind the ball. It's not done particularly well. But Orlando, the way they had a block, the way they counter-pressed in their 3-2 or 2, like, it was everything Orlando did was great, and Atlanta struggled.
So congratulations to Atlanta United. They have the CONCACAF Champions League berth that comes with the U.S. Open Cup Championship. They have, you might call it a double?
I would just say this. If this is, let's just say this is Atlanta having an off year, this is a huge moment for this club.
Yeah.
To just be able to pile up trophies and have the experience of, hey, you're going to come in and watch your team win a trophy every single year. And that's the reality of what your club is. And they've never won this before. So now you're starting to put it together where it's like, well, this is a club that just competes on all fronts and all these
things. They're building their history game by game, championship by championship.
And they've guaranteed CCL for next year.
Right.
So now if you're Darren Eales and Carlos Bocanegra, okay, let's say you have a plan to sell some of your bigger players, or let's say you have a plan of the next guys you want. Now your time window is we need to hit our prime in March of 2020, not August of 2020.
Right. Have Atlanta United now winning Campeones Cup, Open Cup, MLS Cup, and just where they think of themselves, and we've used the word super club, is Atlanta United 2019 bigger than what the LA Galaxy were at any point in their history?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, I don't believe so either.
I don't believe so.
Why?
Because I think LA Galaxy, through their two sort of eras, they were sustained. They won multiple MLS Cups. To me, the multiple MLS Cups will do it. Now, and they're not going to get a shield here either, which the LA Galaxy won too. And they didn't get one last year. What I will say is that it is incredible that they were able to sell maybe the most impactful player in league history in Miguel Almirón and lose Tata Martino, maybe the most impactful coach in league history, and still have a season like this, a season in which we can still sit back and nitpick them, mm-hmm. but ultimately they do have two trophies no matter how you value those. I had some people on Twitter telling me that the Campeones Cup is like a 0.1. It's like a subwoofer. You know, you have the 5.1 sound system. And my response to that is, that's all good. You don't have to value it. But Atlanta United right now is pulling up at the stoplight, and their trunk is rattling. You know they're there. Whether or not you respect it, whether or not you like
it. So Wichita.
Oh, yeah.
Weeby definitely had a subwoofer.
Yeah, I definitely. I had, come on, two tins in the back, bro.
For sure.
What do you think? All right, so congratulations to Atlanta. Sorry to Minnesota. I really wanted them to get the goal.
In his Saturn.
No, it wasn't.
Saturn with a spoiler.
No. Yeah. First it was a Chevy Beretta, and then it was a Nissan Altima. So,
oh,
you know,
the Altima life.
My buddy did have a Saturn, though. Going to throw that one out there. Yeah, look. It is what it is. You can value these trophies however you want it. Atlanta United, meanwhile, are setting a baseline for expectations, I think. And that is anybody who comes into the club, whether it's a coach or a player or a support staff member or a supporter that's new, the expectation is that we will do this. Can they carry that on? Big question, and it'll be a question we answer in the playoffs as well. Speaking of the playoffs, there is a schedule out for you that you should, as I have, copied and pasted and put it on your phone or on your wherever it is. Maybe put it in your Google Calendar. Decision day we knew was the 6th of October. And then we know now when the knockout rounds and the conference semis and the conference finals are. Knockout rounds will be the 19th and 20th. That's the weekend there. So decision day and then a full 2-week break. Of course, the international break takes up about 8 of those days. And then midweek, just after, conference semis. So if you get a bye, if you are the team in the number one spot, you are going to get a team on short rest. You're going to get a time to prepare. You are going to be well rested, or depending on how you view it, rusty. And then you'll have a full week to that next Tuesday and Wednesday, the 29th and 30th, for the conference finals. And then you will have a total of like 9 days until MLS Cup, which is on November 10th. I think the big takeaway from this, one, it's the two midweeks for the semis and finals, but also it's the massive advantage that you will have if you are either a bye team, the number one team, LAFC and Atlanta or who else, maybe Philly or NYCFC, or a team at the top of those next three spots where you don't have to travel. Mm-hmm. Your knockout round game's at home, and then your next game is at home, potentially. Those are the two big advantages to me. Any thoughts on this before we get to Greg Berhalter in the U.S.?
I have a thought on the second point about having the advantage to home field. Andrew, if we go through the teams, especially in the Western Conference, we'll say the Seattle Sounders, the LA Galaxy, or Real Salt Lake. Say Portland gets up there. Say Minnesota. Which of those teams are better as the aggressor in the game? Which of those teams would rather be the team with the ball in a big game than the team who's comfortable sitting eight behind midfield and hitting on the counter?
It's fair. I don't know that any of them are.
It's a trend that's taking place in MLS right now where teams are better sitting and countering than they are causing problems with the ball.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. The one point you would make with you add in the travel part is like when you look at a Galaxy team where you're a little older, do you really want to potentially have to go to a Minnesota in November, right, or October and deal with that and then have to travel again? So for some teams, there's value in just being able to be home, being in your environment, being on your field.
And there's nothing wrong, honestly, as we saw with Atlanta United last year, with getting in the playoffs, even when you're home, saying, you know what, we're going straight pragmatic with this. We know what the deal is. This one game, we screw up once, we have a VAR thing, we have an injury, it could ruin all of our goals. So MLSsoccer.com is your place for the schedule there, all coverage of the U.S. Open Cup, and of course the weekend, which we will get to in just a second. But first, Greg Berhalter, the head coach of the U.S. national team, is on the line. It's an AT&T call to the field. Greg, welcome to Extra Time.
Thank you, guys.
So let's just get right into it. And I was on the call yesterday, the conference call you do after all these roster releases. And you had a little bit of a chuckle after a question about the quote-unquote number 10 experiment with Christian Pulisic. And it got me thinking about the way that we talk about this team positionally and otherwise, and also the way that you talk to your players. So I just want to kind of give you the floor off the jump to help us set a baseline to understand when you're in a film session or you're talking to your players, you're giving them instructions, what are you saying and why isn't it based around positions, quote-unquote?
So I think we all get caught up in you know where the players the exact position or formation and all that. You know, I think coaches are guilty. I'm guilty of it. I think we all are. So that's the starting point. But basically, what we're trying to do is get the players to understand how to use space. I think that's the most important thing. And you know, we have positional principles that we want to follow. And you know, we'll line a player up in one position, but know that he's going to end up in another position because that's where the space is going to be. For us, it's trying to create advantages. And, you know, if you see Mexico, for example, they play with three in midfield, the 4-1-4-1. And, you know, if we have three guys in there, that's no advantage. So we need to find a way to get another guy in central midfield.
So, Greg, to follow up on that, you talked about how you're guilty of it sometimes too. Watching your team early on, it seemed like you had pretty strict positional play. The single pivot, the 2 8-and-10s a little higher, the wingers wide. But the team has changed a little bit. You've brought back one of those 8-and-10s, usually Weston McKennie. Can you talk about the evolution within the team of your positional play and your, rotations through the midfield?
Yeah, that's a good observation. You know, the first thing is, if we're building, say, for example, if you take Mexico and we're building up, you know, with two and then one and then the two attacking midfielders, we will create an advantage against their defensive midfielder, but it'll be very difficult for our six, so to speak, to get the ball against their two central midfielders. So we wanted to bring another player down. We wanted to be able to manipulate their two attacking midfielders to find the space behind them and then overload their defensive midfielder with our 10 and a winger coming inside. So that was the plan there. And at times, you know, we found Jordan Morris and it worked really well. But overall, what I would say about, you know, the question is, you know, I like variation. I don't like when the team gets stagnant. I like interchanging positions. And, you know, we played with the wingers, you know, to really have good balance. But I didn't find that we were flexible enough. I didn't think we were interchanging enough. I didn't love how it looked. And, you know, you guys saw the same thing. So it was about how do we change it up and still be a little more fluid, a little more dynamic.
When we look at this player pool now, the guys you brought in, was there an idea with some of these younger talents or different talent players that they have that flexibility, that they can change the way they play, or is it just giving other players opportunities?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, a guy like Paxton, for example, is very interesting, right, because he plays very well between the lines. He's good dribbling the ball. He can break lines dribbling. You know, he gives you a lot of solutions. But, again, I think it's really early for a guy like him to be able to make an impact at the senior level. But it will be nice in his development. You know, if you think about this year for him, he's a guy that broke into the first team, has gotten solid minutes, has started out really well, has had a dip in form, physically has gotten tired. Now he's rebounding a little, and now it's time to give him another stress to really round out this year of his development. And I'm excited to have him with the men's team and see how he can cope with the speed and with the level of the game.
Can you elaborate?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, can you elaborate on how you know when a player is ready for the national team? Because when I watch a player like Pomacle, and you could insert a bunch of names in there, whether it's the U-20s or just players with their club, who look ready. They look like they're outperforming players that have played for the senior team. How do you know when a player who has stood out for his club or a youth national team is ready for the senior national team?
I don't know. I mean, there's no exact science to it, right? What you do is you try to gauge. I mean, we're watching all the games. We're looking at the speed at which these guys are playing. We're looking at the pressure that's exerted on them in games. You know, is it a very tight game? In the big games, are they able to make an impact? You know, we know the international level is a high level. So what we're looking at is specifically when these guys play in difficult games, how they're doing. You know, for example, I was at LAFC watching Miles Robinson against LAFC and seeing how he's going to cope with a game like that. So we're just getting, you know, we're getting hints. We're trying to make the best possible decision. I think what other people do, and you know, you get excited, right? So a guy plays two good games, and we're saying, oh, he should be a senior national team player now. I think, you know, and even myself, I want to rush the development. But what I'd say is that there is a timing. We try to capitalize on momentum of a player. So as a player, for example, Sergiño Dest, he played the under-20 World Cup. He went back to Ajax. He had a good preseason. He was fighting for a position. He earned a position. He's playing. I mean, this is a great example of momentum. And now's a perfect time for him to get an opportunity.
So you have momentum, and then you have the platform that these guys are going to have to build off of within your team, your system, your structure. Is there an onboarding process for these guys? I know that's like kind of corporate speak, but when what is that process?
Yeah, so it's twofold. The first thing is, you know, explaining our culture, explaining, you know, how we act, how we do things, what the environment is. I think that's really important. You know, what we found in the Gold Cup is these guys, you know, became a really close group. And we found that, you know, the tighter they are, the easier it is for us to reach our goals, which is normal. And then there's the style of play. You know, we sit with these guys. We do video work with them and talk to them about their roles and their responsibilities. And we try to ease that in, that we don't hit them all at once with everything.
Let's talk about that style of play for 1 second, because if you go back to what I would say 2002 and 2010 were the best years the national team had, you are trying to have a different style of play than those teams. Why is now the right time for that?
I just think it's different. You know, it's a different generation of players. You know, we have top level players. I mean, with all respect, in 2010 and 2002, we didn't have a guy at Chelsea. You know, we didn't have a guy getting transferred for $85 million. You know, we have quality players now, and I think it's a different vision. I think people want to see something different. They want to see us, you know, trying to play in a different way. And I want to give the guys confidence, and I want them to believe that we can do it. You know, it's a lot of young players, and there's a lot of possibilities for this group.
Greg, that kind of referenced you and the people outside having a desire for the way this team plays. I often wonder about what the players are feeling in that camp, how they react to tactics, the things that they're saying to you, hey, I want to do it this way. And I even think a little bit about Atlanta United and sort of the struggles they've had this year in the back and forth with Frank DeBoer. How much internal feedback do you get from the players on how you play, and how much do you implement of that?
So we work in a collaborative way. You know, we'll talk to the players. We'll say, okay, guys, how do you feel about this? It's all about getting feedback. You know, we give feedback, but we're also able to accept feedback. And again, it's a collaborative process. You know, I laid out the vision for the group, but they had to be open to it, and they had to say, yes, this is something we want to do. And they said that. And, you know, we're always making little adjustments. We're always tweaking things a little bit. And a lot of it is based on how the players are feeling on the field and how they feel they can execute against that.
So I don't know that you have to give us a specific example or a player name or whatever, but I am curious, what are some of the things that they've come to you and said? What are the collaborative moments where you've had to turn around and say, you know what, you guys have a great idea. Let's try that.
Oh, my gosh. There's dozens of times. It's everything. I mean, we're talking about a specific example will be, you know, how we wanted to high press goal kicks against Mexico. You know, it was largely, you know, feedback from players about, listen, they know I wanted to do it in a zone, and they were saying, listen, we think it's going to work better man to man. And so we switched to man to man. There was no problem. We did it. We analyzed it. We watched video on it. We trained it. And, you know, we made some adjustments, and then we implemented it.
You mentioned when it's a tight-knit group, it's easier for people to become a part of it. What's the culture of this group become early on in your tenure?
So, you know, I think the first thing is that it's a brave group of guys, right? They're not scared to try things. They're not scared to put themselves out there. I think that's really important. What we're asking them to do is difficult, but they've been open to it and brave enough to try it. It's a group that supports each other. It's a group that understands, you know, to get to where we want to go, there has to be sacrifice. And what we ask them to do in and around camp, you know, with the high performance and the, you know, the training and the video, it's a lot. and they've been open to that, and they've been really great about adding to it. You know, an example is the collaborative process and how we play. We do video sessions where it's a conversation, basically. It's me up there, and then guys are talking, and then another guy adds a point, and then we look at it, and then we rewind, and then we go again. I mean, it's not a classroom setting where I'm up there just lecturing.
So I want to get to some more about the communication with the guys and this pool and everything else, but I have to ask some specifics about players here. Josh Sargent in. He was not in for the Gold Cup. What has changed in 4 months? What's different about this situation that means it's time to get Josh in the group?
You know, I think there were two different – I talked to – who was it yesterday? I was talking on the phone to someone they're talking about. Might have been Dunseth or someone else, but we're talking about how, the Gold Cup was a clear objective. We wanted to win the Gold Cup. We took player – we had to construct the roster. You had to have 23 players, and your aim is to win the Gold Cup. I think now is a little bit different when you're moving into these friendlies, and you have a little bit of latitude. You know, we're calling 26 players into camp. And Josh, in particular, is a guy that I loved his response from something not going his way. He went back to Bremen, and, he just grinded. And he worked hard, and he got himself into the starting lineup in preseason. He performed well in preseason. Now he hasn't played much, but it's still a great mindset from a player after a negative event. And, he's a guy that we've always talked about him having a bright future. It's not like we said we don't rate this guy. You know, we really do. We think he's a really good player, and it will be nice to get him involved again.
Greg, I want to go back to the question about pressing before Andrew asks about more players, because I did want to ask what point of the team's play you want to improve. But I'll go ahead and say I thought that pressing, but not just counter-pressing, but specifically trying to win the ball when the other team was building out of the back, might have been the part of the game that the team struggled with most in Gold Cup. Can you walk us through either if you have a different answer or what you're
well,
working?
Let's talk about this, Bobby. I think it's important because in one respect, I agree. Right? What I'd say is that against Curaçao in particular, it was bad. It was not good. Here's the thing we need to understand about Curaçao: like that's their strength. You know, look at the goalkeeper. You see what he's doing in Columbus. He's very good at that. So when you want to, and we didn't spend much time on it up until then, so when we're talking specifically about high-pressing goal kicks, high-pressing, the goalkeeper, you need to be brave, you need to be more man-oriented, you need to understand how you're pressing the goalie, who's pressing the goalie, and in that game, we didn't do that well enough. And so after that game, it was analyzing and saying, okay, guys, how do we want to approach this? It was funny because what happened is that our ego took over a little bit in that game. And what I mean is that if we know that's their absolute strength, and we know that we're not prepared in the way to press them how we want to, why would we press them high? Why don't we just drop back into a mid-block and absorb a little and maybe counter, get the second goal, or keep the ball when we have the ball? And what happened is we're thinking, okay, we're the United States. We're playing against a small country. Why don't we have the ball? Why aren't they just giving us the ball? And, that's not a great mindset. You have to understand the strengths of the opponent and what they can bring and be able to adjust accordingly. What I'd say is that as we moved into Jamaica and Mexico, I thought that changed dramatically. And I thought, our pressing specifically against Mexico, I thought was adaptive. We went from a 4-4-2 to a 4-3-3 to a, to five in the back sometimes. And when we were fit and we were strong, it was really good. There were times when physically we dropped off a little in the second half where, we weren't able to press like we wanted to. But by and large, I thought that part was pretty good.
Thanks for answering that. I think that was a something people have been curious about. While we talk about pressing and the team shape, and I know we said that formations aren't hugely important, but in regards to the way you defended, you had Christian Pulisic play mostly as a second forward, whether that was next to a Jozy Altidore or Jossie Zardes or behind with a defensive midfielder. People always want to know, what's Christian Pulisic's role in this team right now, either as a person or a player?
As a person, he's another member of the team. Right, he's a guy that can lead by performance. He's a guy that is loved by his teammates. It adds to the group dynamic. Brings a unique personality to the group. On the field, he's a guy that can, you know, can change the game. And specifically, you know, he's very good dribbling. He's very good running with the ball. He's good at arriving in the penalty box. If you remember some of his goals from the Gold Cup, even with Chelsea, I think he's arriving well, and something we've been talking to him about. And you know, a very dynamic player. In you know, you referenced him playing next to the striker. You know that in offense he was more of an attacking midfielder. In defense he moves up next to the striker. When we defend in a 4-4-2, you know, we've defended in other ways where he has other roles and responsibilities. But that was primarily what we did in the Gold Cup. There were times against Mexico, like I said, where he shifted over to the left. Josie was central, and Jordan moved up, and we had pressing with three. And that changed a little bit. But, you know, overall, we've been really happy with his contribution to the team.
Take away the results, of course, but the friendlies coming up. What's the focus for you and your group in terms of what you want the team to work on, what you want to get out of it, what you want to develop, whether it's in possession, defensively, or just with the group in general?
So I think that against, Mexico is going to be a great game because that was our last game. And for us, we can analyze, make adjustments, and then see how that works. You know, give the guys real specific tasks to work on that we can improve from that game. And, you know, that's the fun part of it. Again, so we're going to be looking to, you know, make them run more, make them run without the ball. I think we didn't do a good job of that. There's a number of times in the game we play back to Zach, and, you know, he doesn't have enough options to play out, or he's choosing not to play out, and that can't be the case. We need to make these guys run. You know, it can't just be us running around. So that's going to be the priority there. Defensively, we still want to be able to pressure them, still want to be able to move into a higher type of press at times, but we have to be controlled. We have to control the tempo of the game, and something we didn't do well in the final. Against Uruguay, I think it's going to be an interesting exercise of trying to break down a very compact 4-4-2, a very physical, compact 4-4-2. And then, you know, being able to defend some of the quality that they have, we know they're robust, we know they're physical, we know they're well organized, we know there's very little space between their lines. It's going to be about figuring out how to break that down.
So you had a quote, Greg, that I thought was really interesting and also just spot on to Paul Tenorio in The Athletic, excuse me. It was basically that as a fan, I can understand we are thirsty for talent, for people who can come in and make an impact. And I heard the way that you spoke about Paxton, and I'm thinking about Serginho Dest and Miles Robinson and these guys that are coming in and onboarding and getting comfortable.
It's a long list these days, Andrew.
It is. Everybody out there, if you look at Twitter, if you look at the message boards, if you read columns or hear us talk about sometimes, we get excited and we want to see these guys right away. How do you approach in these two games in this camp moving them in? Because there are a lot of people out there who will say, put in Sargent. Let's see Sargent. We've seen Giassi. How do you balance that sort of developmental side as well as the side where you want to go out and perform and execute the things that you work on?
It's a good question. I think that, there's probably going to be some of those guys that may not play in the games, and you guys are going to be disappointed, and that's going to be, you know, how it goes. We'd like to get them on the field. Some of them will get on the field. Some of them will start in the games. And for us, it's about picking the right moment and setting a guy. I think it's setting a guy up for success. You know, when you think about a guy like Serginho Dest, who's playing in these Champions League qualifiers, I mean, these are absolutely crucial fixtures for his club. If they lose this, it's a massive amount of money they're losing. And they have the faith to play this guy in the game. So, you know, my guess is that he's probably ready to play at the international level, and it's worth giving him an opportunity at the international level. Paxton is a different story. You know, he subbed on for Dallas last game. You know, we're talking about a completely different level that this player is at right now. But does he have interesting qualities? Has he shown enough during the year, you know, to bring him into the environment and see how he does? Absolutely. So it's there's not one right answer. And I'm the same way you guys are, except, I want these guys to progress so quickly that I can use them. You know, I think of Gio Reyna. I wish he was, you know, ready to, you know, I wish it was 4 years later and he was at the top of his game. That's exciting to me. Paxton, Miles, you know, all these guys. But I also realize it's a process. I realize it takes time. And what we're doing is gathering as much information as possible to find out if they're absolutely ready.
So process is an interesting word, and we hear it all the time in sports. But, Greg, I think I hear it from you a lot, and I wonder what it means for you, not necessarily sort of in this time or talking about the roster, making those decisions, but literally day to day. You go from the club side and you understand what that is. It's you're with your players every day, you're working on something. What is your day to day like now with the national team? Has it changed? Have you settled into a rhythm? What are you doing?
So that, you know, that's exactly what I'm working on is a strict process, you know, of workflow. And, you know, we define weeks with the coaching staff. They're all here in Chicago, and we say, okay, this week we're going to, you know, analyze our game against Mexico, and we're going to, you know, we're going to make a new structure. We're going to experiment with, you know, coming up with a new structure of how we're going to defend that, say a 3-4-3, for example. And we'll detail all the, you know, the ins and outs of a 3-4-3, how it works in a high block, how it works mid block, how it works low block. And just go, it doesn't mean we're going to use it, but just going through that exercise. The next week we'll focus on, you know, opponent scouting. Well, we'll take Uruguay, for example, and break them down. You know, I'll have weeks where it will be personal development weeks. You know, I was in Sevilla. I know you guys probably saw that with Lopetegui, you know, learning from him, talking to him. Then I went to Switzerland to meet Petkovic, the coach of the Swiss national team, you know, trying to get information, trying to learn more about the international game and how they approached, you know, developing the teams. So it's something that, you know, I'm looking forward actually to this fall because it is regular games. You know, you go September, October, November, so I think there's a nice rhythm to how those games worked. And it will be nice to, you know, after the camps to now settle in, analyze, plan, and then execute. Analyze, plan, and then execute.
One of the big parts of your job that we see you is traveling around, watching your players playing with their club setups. What's the setup in terms of scouting, how often you keep in communication with the players in the pool, and then the other part is with these potential dual nationals, players that you could have coming in but haven't decided if they're part of the U.S., what's the process in terms of talking with them and trying to get them in?
A lot of questions in that one, huh?
I got you, Greg.
Yeah, that was a good one. So every Monday, every weekend, coaches are assigned to watch certain games and analyze certain players. We give players ratings for every single performance. Tuesday we have a call, which usually lasts about just a meeting, which usually lasts about 5 hours, and we review every player's performance and all the games, MLS games, foreign games. And we talk about their ratings. We watch video clips of their games. We want to have a very good understanding of what these players are doing. So that's a big portion of our time. We'd like to get out to the clubs, meet the people, talk to the coaches. And that's something we're continuing to develop. You know, I talked to a club yesterday, and they said, well, why don't you come in and talk to the coach about how we should use this guy? I thought it was a great idea, and we need to do that more. You know, another club yesterday, MLS club, we had a plan of how we're going to develop this player. We had a conference call and talked about, you know, how we're going to get this player to the top of his game to help both the club and the country. So that work's been good. In terms of dual nationals, I think that, you know, we have a responsibility as a federation to be tracking these players and to be communicating with these players, most importantly. And then we need to show them that we have the environment that's going to make them better. You know, I'm a firm believer in, you know, we want to create an environment that's both enjoyable and the players believe they can progress in. And if we do that, you know, hopefully they'll choose for us. There's going to be cases where they don't choose for us, and there's going to be personal reasons that dictate that. And we're going to have to live with that. But if we give our best effort, you know, to either keep these players or attract these players, I think we can live with the result.
A five-hour conference call once a week breaking down every player in the pools. You could
amazing.
Sell tickets to that.
Yeah,
I will send you my number, Greg. I'll mute myself. Just throw me on the back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hundreds of dollars.
You can be part of it one time.
Oh, you heard that. That's on the record. That's on the record.
You guys won't do it, though. I know you won't.
Are you kidding me? We will. I will book my own flight to Chicago. I will literally fly to Chicago right now and like camp outside of the soccer house. Last one, Greg. And I know people have been on you about the communication with younger players, et cetera, and this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I just wonder how that works with you. Like, you know, it is an interpersonal relationship. So are you on TikTok? Are you on Snapchat? Are you Instagram messaging off stories? Like, how is it that you keep in touch with the Pulisics and the Adams and everybody else and all these other people within your pool and make them feel sort of like they're part of the family?
Yeah, I'm talking to those guys all the time, you know, mostly via WhatsApp. You know, that's the mode of communication most times. But a lot of times it's a phone call, you know, and just checking in, saying how you're doing, and, you know, what's the situation, how's training been. You know, I really want to stay in touch with these guys. And also careful, though, not to infringe on, you know, I don't want it to be, I don't want them to feel like it's a responsibility that they, you know, that they have to talk to me. You know, I just want it to be organic, and I want it to be casual, and just staying in touch and making sure that they're on the right track. In regards to these younger players, you know, the 15, 16-year-olds or guys that haven't, you know, haven't really played in MLS, but, you know, have the, you know, have options to play with the national team, it's, you know, it's not really my role to be connecting with those players. You know, that's where we have, you know, youth technical directors and sporting directors and you know, and other people that should be connecting with them, I think. You know, if I see them casually, of course I'm going to talk to them and make them feel welcome, but I'm not the primary source of contact for some of the, you know, the 15-year-olds.
Greg, I think we've taken too much of your time. Off to get some work done here on this day and prepare for this camp. Yeah, I mean, exactly. We're going to jump on a flight right now. Thank you so much, Greg, for joining us.
You bet, guys. Take care.
All right, got to say, big thank you to Greg Berhalter for sharing about 25 minutes of his day here on this Thursday. You heard him. They plotted out. There's a schedule. They got to keep it. We know the roster now, 26 names in for these games against
Google
Mexico.
Google mapping how long it takes to
Uruguay.
Drive to Chicago.
Yeah, this is a road. This is a road trip opportunity. I did just like blaze past. We're obviously doing extra time from Chicago. Like
soccer
next
Haas.
Week, the yeah. week after that, I well, guess they're in camp.
That's
so.
What I just realized when I said we'll
okay.
be there next week.
All right,
we'll wait a little.
We'll
let we'll him
share,
breathe
we'll
a little.
Share calendars
yeah.
with U.S. Soccer and Greg Berhalter and make sure there's a time that this can
we
happen.
We don't want to look too needy.
Yeah.
You gotta, like,
I think
little.
The word Greg used was thirsty.
Yeah.
We're looking a little bit thirsty right now. Thoughts, Bobby, on this roster, on these two games? I mean, we'll dig into it more, but something quick that just kind of jumps
yeah.
to mind.
The biggest question I have going in is who plays defensive midfield? Michael Bradley not going because Toronto has two big games. Maybe Michael Bradley hasn't been informed to start anyway. No Tyler Adams. So does Will Trapp act as a single pivot? Weston McKennie, we already heard Paxton Pomykal probably won't play. So who does Greg Berhalter put at that defensive midfield position?
Dave? Who do you want to see? What do you want to see? In your mind's eye.
Well, Paxton would have been one of the things
yeah.
I wanted to see.
So. I think he, you know.
So that's not an option.
There's some cold water on that. Yeah. Like, lessened expectations a bit.
I think it'd be fun to watch Miles Robinson at this level to see what his potential is and how he can fit into, obviously, a deeper part of the pool, but he's one of the younger players. How does he contend in that? And everyone's talking about Des, so I'll just throw it out there. Just in terms of, like, I thought he struggled defensively with the U-20 World Cup team, and I think part of that was growing up in Ajax, it's so structured, and coming outside of that structure, how does he now handle playing outside of a team that just dominates possession and plays a specific way with guys he's always grown up playing? And he has abilities that no one else in the U.S. pool has. So how do you find a way to maximize those?
I'm going
to
go with Josh Sargent. You know, no Josie
Midwest.
Here.
You
no
always
Josie
go Midwest.
Here. Yeah, you know, St. Louis is coming to the league. Got to see Josh Sargent. I just feel like it was this whole talking point this summer. What could he be? What might he be? Why isn't he getting time? Where is he? And he hasn't really played for Bremen so far. And Greg said, you know, we're not really worried about that. We're more worried about the reaction. Well, what is the reaction now if he doesn't play or if he doesn't get time? I don't think he's going to start.
Right.
But I would like to see him off the bench, at least just for a cameo, just to have that thing in your mind's eye to say, oh, okay, that's what he maybe looks like with this team, and to give him something to spark him on as well. Let's talk about the weekend. MLS, these playoff races are heating up. That's why we're talking about the format. If the playoffs started today, you know LAFC would be the first overall seed. Atlanta would get a bye. Then you'd have Philly, Montreal. They face off in the knockout round. NYCFC, New England, Red Bulls, and DC United. That's a little bit juicy there. RSL, Dallas, Seattle, San Jose, and LA Galaxy, Minnesota. We don't have those matchups this weekend, but we do have basically must wins. Montreal, thanks to Evan Bush's heroics on the PK stop, got a 2-1 win midweek. That might have gone under the radar for you, but I guarantee it did not go under the radar for Wilmer Cabrera and the Impact. They are going to host DC United in what is, I believe, again, a must win for them. And we have some mail about DC United, I believe.
Yeah, the Road Rambler sent us an essay, so I appreciate it. And I'm just going to take out one little bit from this, which is he's very worried about DC United. He had a lot of questions about this. But for Bobby, he asked specifically Felipe, who for many people is one of the most, I'm just going to use the word hated.
Beloved. Sorry, my bad.
Yeah. Players in the league, mm-hmm. both players and fans. He now comes into your locker room. How do you handle that?
That is a good question.
You are on DC this year, so you're, you know, you're a little desperate. Things are not going the way you wanted them to.
But you did, let's say, face him when he was with the
Rebels. Yeah, he wound you up, as he does many.
You appreciate what he brings. It's hard anytime a player comes midseason, even a DP, right? I'll acknowledge that if you're not... If he takes somebody's spot, he's taking the spot of either somebody on the team or a friend of the other 20 guys on the team. So it's always hard. I would say if you're DC, you're a little bit realistic as to what you need right now, specifically bite and energy and just any revigoration going into the final stretch. You understand, but it's always a little bit hard when a new player comes in.
I will watch Lassie Lapalainen at any time. I just want to see him in the open field. It's like Roadrunner. Beep, beep. He just kind of like his legs start flying and all of a sudden he's five steps by a guy. Montreal need to win. They need to accumulate points. Any other games we're watching for playoff reasons? Well, oh, by the way, Yamil Assad.
Yeah,
I didn't mention that.
Yeah, so DC United sounds like I've finally sealed that one. So maybe he hasn't played in a while, so he might not be ready, but maybe that helps spark something with the
Weird. Weird. Maybe you should have done that one a month ago.
What position, though?
Steven Goff threw that out there. Left back seems to be a position of need for them at this point, so I'm sure that we will see him there. I'm going to throw out some other games that I will definitely be watching. I think Philly-Atlanta is super interesting because we keep anointing Atlanta because they keep having these big moments. Philly hasn't had that sort of like, win a trophy, lift a trophy, but this would be a big one.
It feels like a lot of Philly's big games have been on the road. And so there's always been like the expectations. This is a legitimate, like, you're the number two seed in the Eastern Conference right now. You win this game, you solidify yourself, but also you show like, if you come into our building in the playoffs, we are going to control the game. We're the formidable opponent. So this would be a, you know, interesting moment. They took care of DC basically twice in 2 weeks, which has thrown DC out, which to their credit, because that was a team they were battling with over the first 3 months of the season. Say you were the top team in the Eastern Conference. This is now the team you're battling with to do that as
well.
And
it's 6 points, not just in the table, not just like, hey, we finished above you, Atlanta United, but to go back to that playoff format to say, we get the home game.
Mm-hmm.
This is an opportunity to take 3 points from them, three for us, head-to-head. We take the home game. We take pole position in the Eastern Conference because it is 48-48 and then NYCFC on 47 points. That's a big one. 7:30 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Plus for that. There are some rumblings that Barco will not play in that game for Atlanta, and you also wonder what it will be like for them hitting the road after winning a trophy midweek. I don't know, Bobby, did you ever win a midweek trophy? Did you go drinking afterwards or no?
No.
No? I did see champagne in the locker room for Atlanta. Well-deserved champagne, but we'll see how that might affect them. New England-Toronto, that's a big game. Toronto just beat Montreal, but they go on the road to a team that haven't lost to anybody but LAFC since May. Portland-RSL, two teams, one of which that I believe is currently second because it's hard to figure out with the Western Conference. Yeah, RSL are currently second with four teams trailing them within 2 points, and five teams within 3 points.
And Portland are not in the playoffs.
37 points, and they've just lost two straight at home.
Brian Fernandez will not play winger.
Probability they get into the playoffs, David.
Who?
Portland Timbers.
Well, how do I have to do this? Can I do a percentage?
Yeah.
70%.
70? That feels low.
Really?
I was going to say 95.
Oh, wow. You were locked in.
9-5. 9-5. You're not going to give a percentage? 53-47?
We got to move on the show.
Okay. Not enough time. Seattle LA on Sunday. Obviously, that's going to be a fun game. And LAFC Minnesota as the Loons try to prove something before they get out of here. We do have another guest here we need to chat about because there's a new DP in Major League Soccer. That's Hani Mukhtar. He arrived on a private jet to Nashville this week, coming over from Brøndby. He will stay in Denmark until preseason time, but it is a big transaction for Nashville SC. And their general manager is on the line now to chat with us. That is Mike Jacobs. It's an AT&T call to the field. Mike, welcome to Extra Time.
Hey, Andrew, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Let's just jump right in. Hani Mukhtar, saw the private jet, saw the photos, see the resume. Looks like a 10 that could really make a difference in this league. What did you see with him? How'd you scout him? And what does this signing mean to Nashville?
Well, you know, I think for us early on in our roster build, the idea of trying to focus our resources on trying to bring in, you know, a 10 from outside of our league, you know, the reality is when you look at best practices, and you look at the idea of, you know, where tens or nines come from, you know, in most cases, they're not coming from within MLS to acquire a player. And, you know, if you look at the top 20 in goals scored last year in MLS, 19 of those top 20 players were either DP or CAM guys. You know, the exception was Daniel Shalloway, who's a homegrown from Sporting Kansas City. And, you know, for us, I think as we looked at who we were going to acquire in our build, you know, the idea was that we were probably going to bring someone from abroad in that role. And very early on in that process, it became very apparent to us that player was going to be Hani.
what about him was so attractive to you? I know he hasn't played a ton recently for Brøndby, but his numbers when he has played are very, very good, and we know him from the German youth national teams as well. What were the attributes that you saw and said, you know what, that's going to work in MLS, that's going to work with what we're building?
Yeah, it was as our staff started shortlisting players and looking at what we thought Gary wanted out of a 10, it wasn't only someone that we thought could create and finish scoring chances, but it also was someone who's more of like a universal-type player, more of a two-way-type player, both on and off the ball as far as his work rate. And, you know, when you look at guys who've done really well in our league in that role, I think very quickly Hani started to kind of fill a bill for us. And when you look at his pedigree, you know, to have the experience he's had representing his country at the youth levels, is at U19 and U20 with Germany, both in the Euros and the U20 World Cup. You look at his great success that he's had at Brøndby. You know, it was obviously he was a very strong club and in the Danish league. You know, for us, we thought that his skill set, the things he offered, and really his fit as far as what we were looking for, we thought was kind of a natural for us.
You guys have already made a couple signings, but your first DP is always going to be one that sets the tone both on the field but also off the field. Culturally, what was the key? And when you've discussed with Hani what he brings to the team and what you're hoping he is for the group?
I think when you look at putting a group together, what's important is like their cohesiveness. And you look at them, almost like puzzle pieces. Not only who's a good player, but you know, who's going to be a good player with the players we have, with our manager, and what kind of fit they have. And you know, I think having someone who is English speaking, you know, I think in our locker room we're probably going to have, you know, primarily English and Spanish speaking players on our roster. You know, knowing that where he is German born, you know, he is fluent in English was certainly important. You know, his character and his work ethic, you know, I think he's somebody who has played in teams that win a lot. And for us, you know, I think it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy of trying to bring in players with expectations of competing to try to pursue championships. I think his pedigree, as well as like his attitude and kind of like his whole, you know, we talk a lot about like the NSC DNA. I think, you know, just his whole profile kind of fit what we look for in players.
So now to ask you about the other side of that coin, if you look at the players that have recently come from Scandinavian leagues, I'll give the examples of Magnus Eriksson and Wolf Eichram. Good players, but maybe not DP level. When you evaluate the Scandinavian league, did you have those in mind? How do you weigh those in to the decision?
Well, yeah, I think there's certain parts of the world that have translated to our league. And, you know, I think the reality is, you know, each player is different. It's not cookie cutter. You know, when you look at who Hani is and what he represents, the age he's at, only 24, the success he's had, I mean, he was player of the year in Danish league 2 years ago. You know, he's not a run-of-the-mill player coming from the League X. You know, he's somebody who we think is a fairly known entity as far as the things that we know he can do and we believe will translate in our league.
I saw the private jet, Mike, and I was, as I was with Darlington Nagby, absolutely ecstatic to see that. I mean, that shows a commitment. And when you think about the next two DPs and all these other signings, it shows a commitment not just to your fan base, but to other people out there that might have the type of player that you want. What did that signal? Was that intentional on your guys' part to get him on the private jet?
Look, we're very fortunate to have an ownership group led by John Ingram, who is really committed to how he wants to do things. And, you know, I think you hear about the word culture, and it's thrown around quite a bit in business and sport. And look, in not so many terms, you know. But, you know, culture really is, you know, that's how we do things around here. And you know, I think whether it's from, you know, John's personal or professional life to what echoes and kind of like permeates into our club, we want to be looked at in the marketplace as someone who's going to have high expectations for how we treat our players. And you know, what I think is really encouraging was not only does it hopefully you know, show how significant someone like Hani is, but I think to other potential prospects and to their agents. You know, the feedback we've gotten, I think people who want to be treated like Hani, to be given the opportunities that he's been given, not only as far as how he brought him to the States, but how we treated him. You know, to me, I think it shows that we're going to do things that are uniquely Nashville. We're going to do things that are held at a high standard.
So, Mike, you're telling me that when David Akam wins the Most Valuable Player Award for your team, you're going to fly him to the award ceremony in a private jet?
So when he wins the league MVP? Or
yeah.
MVP? Bobby made a prediction last year that David Akam was going to be the MVP of this league.
And it's going to happen in Nashville, Andrew.
He's betting on it. He's betting
What
on
better
it.
Place than Nashville to be MVP?
I don't disagree.
I'll tell you what. Look, I had a chance to watch Bobby play when he was growing up with FC Delco. You know,
and you thought I was going to be league MVP?
I'll tell you what, with me and my picture wasn't true that him being MVP at ESP when he was going to be a senior in high school. If Dave ended up, meeting his expectations, I'd be okay with that.
So, David Akam, part of six players now on your roster. You've got a coach. What's next? What is the to-do list look like? What are the meetings like? What's the focus over the next few weeks and then months?
I think whether it's fans or pundits, and you look at expansion teams, I can appreciate that people will look at transactions and look at them, one by one, and look at each transaction and try to handicap the armchair quarterback, whether it's a good signing or not. And, the reality is, our hope is that, that people can appreciate that we've got a pretty clear plan and vision in place. And, where the pieces drop ultimately and, when signings come to fruition, it's kind of case by case by each deal in regards to the player or their agent, regards to, how we're able to work within certain windows. And, for us, everything has kind of fallen into place so far as targets we've had, we've been able to acquire. I mentioned before about the idea of maybe cohesiveness. I think making sure that the players that we sign not only are good players, they all kind of fit together. And, for us, I think we've got a couple more signings that could happen here over the next month. Because we don't currently play in MLS, we're not acquiring players for this season. So even though our window is closed, we're still very actively involved in signing players retroactive January 1. And I think, you will see over the next month or two some more signings will be announced that hopefully, fans and media alike will appreciate.
So I feel like in that answer, what I'm sussing out, Mike, is sort of this, I don't know what I would call it, like the way to analyze expansion teams du jour is to compare them to previous expansion teams. In your mind, as you build this expansion team, that sort of analysis or analogy just doesn't fit to you. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, look, every team is should we probably look at case by case. I don't think it's cookie cutter, and I think the reality is there's a lot of challenges to building an expansion team. You can look at it as a burden, but also as a tremendous opportunity, and it's one that I know myself and our staff are really excited about to try to grow out the expansion team from scratch. And the reality is each market's different. I can't speak for what other clubs did or didn't do, although I can say that we're very thoughtful as far as not only analyzing best practices of what expansion teams that have done well, what they've had success with, but we've also looked at expansion teams on the flip side, maybe that haven't done as well, and maybe where their shortcomings have been. And for us, we've been really strategic and calculated about not only the players that we've kind of approached so far to sign that have been announced, but even just in our overall roster build. And, I think it's, I can appreciate wanting to look at each signing one at a time to try to assess how a group's doing. But I think it's kind of short-sighted and in some cases maybe a little naive to try to assess something like that without seeing the whole thing kind of in place.
Last one for you. We've got expansion draft coming up after the season. Should we expect another DP signing before then?
It's absolutely, possible. I don't want to create a timetable for us, but I would expect to see at least one DP signing, prior to the start of the season.
We're so excited to see how Nashville is built. Mike, you're in the early processes of it. We'll let you go, get back to work. Thanks for sharing on Hany Mukhtar and everything else.
Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, big thanks to Mike. He says he tried to recruit you to Duke, Bobby. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you didn't want to? Didn't more of a Stanford guy.
He went
I guess.
To the Duke yeah. of the West Coast.
Gotcha. God. All right. So, thoughts on Nashville before we get out of here? Hany Mukhtar. I mean, he has a good resume. There is a little bit of a blip lately yeah. for him, but
well, I think one of the things that's interesting is this, which is they have a coach already, so they have a style they're trying to build, and so it's not just can we get the best possible number 10 out there. It's can we bring someone in who we can get value because he's going to fit what we want to do, which is. Let's just say Gary Smith's pass, which is sit in and counter. Do you get a guy who's good in transition, a guy who's good in the open field, who can maybe be a one-man counterattack himself? So that's kind of what you're looking for.
And David Akam would, by the way, fit a little bit into that.
And Daniel Rios, a big center forward that they have in front of them. And obviously they're going to make 25 to 30 more moves. So this isn't what we're going to see in the end. But I would just say from an external point of view, I would trust Mike Jacobs and what he's doing as his experience in MLS as GM, having the position he needs to have in the club to make the decision over, and let's say the obvious example, anyone that was associated with FC Cincinnati when they started to build their team. Jacobs has more experience in the league. He's been a part of winners, and he has been closer to the role he is currently holding. that anyone did with that club. So when you start to try and compare and say, where are you bringing guys in? What's the profile of players? I would trust what he's doing.
And Gary Smith won an MLS Cup from a presumed spot of competitive disadvantage.
With the Rapids.
Yes.
Yeah,
in 2010.
For sure. It was against the odds, you might say. Mm-hmm. I think I'm with you on that one. I don't think Nashville are going to turn over their entire front office within a couple months, as well as their coaching staff. It feels like more of a stable environment to build from, but there are a lot of moves left to go. It's up to you how you compare them to other teams, to be honest with you. Everybody has their own opinion, and you get to share them. 401-206-0MLS, extra time at MLSsoccer.com. A little bit of a program note before we get out of here. Labor Day. We will not be in this studio, but we will have a show for you. Ikel Parra, DeMarcus Beasley, Jackson Ewell,
Austin Deleuze,
talking about life in USL and what it means to be the face of a club down there in the league and what he's going to do next. So tune in for that. We'll have it first thing for you on Labor Day to accompany you on your drive or your barbecue or whatever it is. But for now, we got to get out of here. Big thanks to Greg Berhalter. Thank you to Mike Jacobs for taking the time to talk to us about their new DP. Big thanks to Bobby for finding a way to get David Akam for MVP into this show. We're going to shake it out here before we get out of here. Okay. Dave and I will get the handshake going. Yeah, we'll see you on Monday, everybody.